Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning with co-host Tammy Flanagan, who will be talking about phased retirement, and we'll probably talk about the, is it the DOMA decision?
Yeah, the Supreme Court's decision to overturn DOMA.
The Supreme Court decision, definition of, what is it?
Defensive Marriage Act.
Defensive Marriage Act.
Yeah, that was overturned last Wednesday.
Sounds
big news. That's huge
it?
News.
Okay, and Tammy, of course, is Senior Benefit Director of NITP, Weekly GovExec columnist and co-host of the show, and I'm the other co-host of the show, Bob Lines. I'm an accounting, finance, tax type. Anyway, so I'm going to be listening and hopefully ask some intelligent questions. So, Tammy, let's go. Phased retirement. What does it mean?
Well, this is a year-old legislation that was passed into law July of 2012, actually. And what we've been waiting for is a series of processes that have to take place in order for this to actually be implemented. So after the law was signed by the president last July, it went over to the Office of Management and Budget for them to take a look at how it would impact the federal budget to offer phased retirement. Then it went over to be put into regulation. And so now these regulations have gone out for comment, and the comment period is going to end the middle of August. But the regulations have been put out, and people can look at them. I've printed out all 86 pages of them today, and I had a chance to review some of this. And so the phased retirement is going to allow a federal employee who is eligible to retire. They have to be eligible for regular retirement. They have to be a full-time employee for at least the last 3 years. In other words, they can't already be a part-time employee. They also have to be an employee who is not subject to mandatory retirement like law enforcement or firefighters. And so these employees, instead of just going cold turkey and retiring, they can retire 50%, which means they would come back to work after they retire and work 20 hours a week instead of 40. And at the same time, they would collect 50% of their retirement check. So if they're a CSRS or a FERS employee, that basic retirement benefit would be cut in half. So if they have 30 years of service, they would collect half of that 30-year retirement.
Hopefully an easy question. Is it always 50-50?
The law allows different divisions. It could be 20-80. It could be 30-70. But currently, OPM and the regulations only specify 50-50 just to make it easier to implement and less confusing for the employee and for the agencies. So right now, yes, 50-50.
And does it have a phase out where after a certain date, it's not available anymore?
Well, in the regulations, agencies will be able to specify a date. So if you came to your supervisor and you said, I'd like to enter phased retirement, and they agree with that, and they say, okay, you know, we're going to come up with an agreement, in the formal letter that authorizes you to do this, because the agency has to agree, they can specify an ending date. They can say, well, okay, you can do this for up to 5 years. Or they can leave it open-ended, where whenever you decide you want to stop being a phased annuitant and go into full retirement, you would then apply for full retirement. So it's going to be a joint election between the employee who wants to do it and the agency who's going to accept the application for the employee. So it has to be agreeable for both parties.
I found it interesting. Last month, did a fair number of seminars, and I mentioned this, and I'd say half the classes go, what?
Well, the reason why nobody is really going to be well-versed on it yet is because it hasn't been implemented. Nobody can do it yet, so we still have to wait for this comment period to end, and then OPM has to actually create the forms so you can apply for phased retirement and then issue the final regulations and the instructions so the agencies know how to implement it and the employees know how to apply for it. So we're still not there yet. I'm thinking probably this fall you'll see your first phased retirees go into action, but we're getting ready because this is good news that we've seen these proposed rules that have come out by OPM that were issued on June 5th, and the comment period ends on August 5th. So we're still about a month away before the comment period is over, and we can get into the weeds and really start to implement this.
Now, the phase, let's say it's 50-50, so they get half their retirement entitlement. And that would that include, I would imagine, if one elected a survivor's annuity at retirement, it would be half of the lower number?
No, what happens is when you enter phased retirement, let's give you an example. Let's say you have 30 years of service, a classic example of somebody who's 55 under civil service with 30 years, or 56 or 57, your minimum retirement age under FERS with 30 years. Okay, let's start with CSRS. Let's say you're a civil service retirement system employee with 30 years. That retirement for 30 years provides 56.25%. Let's just say 56% of your high three. So if your high three was, just to use a round number, I know not everybody makes $100,000, but I have to add in my head. So let's say that your high three were $100,000. So 56% of that's $56,000. Now, instead of collecting $56,000, you collect half of that, which would be $28,000. Am I doing the math right?
Oh, you're right.
You're
on.
The accountant. So $28,000, you get half of your retirement, and then your salary was $100,000, so you're going to get half of your salary, which would be $50,000. So 50 plus 28, you're now up to what, $78,000 a year?
You're doing fine.
All right, so you're getting less than you were making as an employee, but you're only working 20 hours a week, but you're getting more than you would have had you retired fully, which would have only been $56,000. Now you're getting $78,000. So you're getting a little bit of both. So during that period of time, if you were to die during the phased retirement, it would be treated as a death in service based on your salary and based on whatever your retirement would have been had you fully retired the day you died. So it'd be treated as a death in service, which means you don't have any reduction to that annuity, to that phased annuity for survivor benefits. You'll make that election when you fully retire at the end of this period. So that's kind of another real advantage to this, because you're not paying for survivor benefits while you're in a phased annuity period.
I mean, from an overall perspective, is there a disadvantage?
Yeah, the disadvantage is, number one, you're only going to get really virtually 50% credit for that additional time. Now, this is where it gets a little bit loopy, because even though you're working 20 hours a week, you're getting full-time credit for that period, which at least that's what it says in the law. But at the end of the period of time, so let's say you do this for 5 years. So let's move on the example. So you got this 30-year employee who moves into phased retirement. So they do this for 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, you've got 35 years of service, which would provide a retirement benefit of 66% of your high three. And let's just keep the number 100,000. So 66% of 100,000 is 66,000. Okay, so now you're going to get half of that, which is 33,000, plus the 50% that you were getting of the original retirement, which was the 28,000. And if you add that together, that's your new hybrid retirement. And from there, you're going to deduct survivor benefits. But that's really the same as if you were to say, what's the calculation for working part-time for that 5 years, right? 50%. So however you want to slice it, you're getting 50% rather than full credit for those other 5 years. Yeah, because you would have had the full 66,000 rather than a little bit less. But you are still accruing additional retirement benefit, which is something you would not be doing if you went into the old re-employed annuitant status where they waive the salary offset. Because those employees who are doing that dual compensation waiver are not getting additional retirement benefits. So that's one of the big differences between those two types of, you know, moving into this kind of semi-retired status.
Okay. Now, while I like your example of the 100,000, some people are going to say, but you can multiply 100 times whatever percent. So if you make half of it, it's half. If you make three quarters of it, it's three quarters. If you make a third, it's a third. And it's just it's an easy number to work with. It's not to say that everybody makes $100,000.
Yeah, in fact, I think in the column I wrote on this, I used 75,000. So I had the chance to sit down and do the math with a pencil and paper. But just take half of what, you know, if you go to your retirement office, your human resource office, and have them run you a retirement estimate for the date that you plan to start this phased retirement, then cut the estimate in half.
Yeah.
And then look at your salary, cut your salary in half and add those two together. That would be your income during that period of phased retirement. And at the end of that, you can project another retirement estimate as if you had worked 50% of the time for those next 5 years or 3 years or 15 years, however long you want to do it, and then recalculate the benefit.
Now, I'm sure you said this, but if I did this and I was under the 50% rule, with regards to my contribution to FERS or CSRS, is it based on the 100% or the 50%?
That's a good question. That's something I have proposed.
Sorry.
As a question. That's okay. I mean, that's one of the questions.
This is a first in 22 years.
Well, there's some things, and that's for this comment period, because when you read this proposed regulations, I couldn't see in there specifically, and I might have missed it. Somebody who might know could call in and correct me, but I couldn't see in here whether or not they would deduct the 7% for civil service or the 0.8% for FERS off of your full salary or just off of the salary that you're actually receiving, which I would think it would be off the salary you're receiving. That's my guess, because you're only getting 50% credit.
That would be my guess.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know for sure, because they do treat it as full career. And the other nice thing about this, as a retiree, you know, you're paying your health insurance out of your retirement check. You would be paying your health and life insurance out of your paycheck, and the life insurance would still be based on your full salary. So if you get a pay increase or promotion, or if there's a congressional pay increase, that would increase the value of your life insurance, whereas if you had been retired, your life insurance stays at your salary when you retired. So it's another benefit to that.
What happens if I do this and I go, you know, this really sounds good, and a year into it, I go, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I really do want to retire. Is there a drawback to that, or is it kind of like I want to test?
No, you just go ahead and retire, and you get credit for the time that you worked phased retirement. Now, the other thing somebody might decide is the opposite of that. They can say, well, I'm doing this for a year, and I don't like the fact I'm not getting my full salary, and the boss is still making me doing 40 hours of work and 20 hours of time, so I might as well just work full time. So you can go back and stop the phased retirement and go back to full-time employment, and they would just treat that as a period of part-time service.
So it's kind of like a do-over?
You can have according to this, you can have a do-over, yes. From what I'm reading in these phased regulations, they will allow it to end. And go back to full-time employment, which is kind of interesting.
And on holidays, I mean, you would get the same holiday or...
Yep, you still have the same holidays. You would still have your leave, so you wouldn't get paid. Normally when a person retires, they get paid a lump sum payment for their leftover annual leave. Well, you wouldn't get that lump sum payment because your leave would still stay in your account. You could still use it. You would still accrue leave as you continue to work, so... You'd still have leave accrual. Same with sick leave. You would still continue to accrue your sick leave. Your unused sick leave wouldn't get added into your length of service until you fully retired.
Okay. We're by the way, listeners, this is July 1st, 2013. And so here's my question. We have July 4th coming up. Would I get paid for half of my normal salary for that day?
I would think so, yeah. I guess, because you're only working 20 hours a week. So you're going to get paid for 20 hours a week. No matter what.
Yeah.
And so if there's a holiday in there, you would still get that. Now, if you work on that holiday and you normally get time and a half, I don't know. Yeah, that's getting into the weeds with pay matters. So I never claimed to be a pay expert. So you'll have to talk to your payroll office about those things.
You're too modest. Anyway, we're at 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Again, it's July 1st. 2013. It is 10:20. We're on till about 10:58. I only say that because if you're listening and they kindly rebroadcast this show a significant number of times during the month, don't call us. You can email us. We'll talk about the email in a little bit. All righty. Back to this. All righty. So what other questions? Have you had anybody in class pepper you with these questions?
Oh, yeah. And it's surprising, too, because I will ask the class, because as you said, a lot of employees don't even know that phased retirement is an option yet, or it really isn't yet, but they haven't heard about the legislation. So when we bring it up, number one, I'm surprised at how many people think it's a good idea. A lot of employees, I'd say when I ask for a show of hands, I'll see anywhere from 30 to 50% of the class who says they would consider doing it. Because I'll say, how many of you would consider this option? And they're like, oh, yeah, it sounds great, because it eases you into retirement. I think that's the real benefit to the employee, is that a lot of people are financially ready to retire. They know they can afford it. They're just not mentally there. They still like what they do. They still feel like they have a mission at work. And so allowing them to work 20 hours a week so they can be partially retired, I think, is a real attraction to someone who is financially but not yet mentally ready to leave that job. So I think that's been a real issue, a real benefit to this, and gives employees a reason to want to do it. Now, another technical thing, some people owe money to the retirement fund. We call it a deposit. So you might have to pay for military service to get credit for it, or you may have to pay for temporary civilian service, or maybe you took a refund and you owe the money back. So if you wanted to pay those deposits prior to your retirement, you have to pay them or make the decision about whether or not you're going to pay them before you enter phased retirement. So for someone who's on the fence about paying their deposits, they would have to make that decision before they entered into this agreement for phased retirement, because those won't be taken care of at the end. So that part of the retirement will be adjudicated or finalized when the employee enters into the phased retirement period, from what I'm reading here.
Okay. I'll just make a comment on that because I'm trying to get into some of the listeners' heads. We say, well, I can't do it. I don't have the money to do it. Well, take a loan. I wonder if you could take a thrift loan. I don't know about that. But I could take a loan, and I could use the additional money that I got to pay the loan back. So I really...
Yeah, so in a way, that might be a way to pay your deposit and allow you to pay it while you're still working.
Yeah.
Which brings up a whole nother tier to this, a whole nother side to this to look at. What about TSP? Because if we get into FERS employees, you know, I gave the example of a CSRS employee who pretty much has their retirement wrapped up in their civil service annuity. So for them, it kind of looks a little, to me, a little bit more clear cut. But for a FERS employee, you've got those three benefits. You have Social Security, you have TSP, and you have the basic benefit. So let's say we have that FERS employee who has 30 years of service. And if they're under age 62, they're only going to get 30%, 1% a year of their high three. So if you go into 30% of $100,000, that's only $30,000 full annuity. Cut that in half, that's only $15,000. You add that to half the salary, now we're only up to $66,000, not $78,000 like we had the civil service employee. So this employee still needs another $12,000 to come out to where the CSRS employee would have been with the same circumstance. So what about the FERS supplement or Social Security if you're over 62? You're not going to get it. Number one, the supplement's not payable to a phased annuitant. It's not in the law. It's not available. So number one, you would forfeit the FERS supplement. And if you are over 62, you're making too much money to collect Social Security unless you're over 66. Now, if you're over 66, there's no earnings limit, which means you could go into phased retirement and you could collect your full Social Security at the same time. For that employee, I think there's a real something there to think about.
So let me try to put it in my own non-eloquent terms. Mm-hmm. If I'm below 66 and I'm FERS, I need to do some paper and pencil.
Mm-hmm. Because you're not going to be
able
to...
You're not saying it's not...
Not saying it's not doable. Right. Maybe you can still afford to do it, but you're still making too much money for Social Security when there's an earnings test, and you're not going to get the supplement because it just doesn't provide it. So the only person who's going to collect Social Security as a phased annuitant would be someone who is over the full Social Security age, which is currently 66, moving to 67. Now, the third tier of FERS is thrift. And so we've heard from the thrift. The thrift plan has made it clear that the phased annuitant is still an employee, which means they can still contribute to the TSP, but which also means you can't start your TSP distributions yet as far as, you know, being a retiree. So you can still make contributions, but you're not going to be able to access your TSP as an annuitant. In other words, you can't do a monthly payment yet. You can't do the TSP annuity yet because you're still technically an employee. So again, the FERS employee is going to have a little bit of a shortfall, more so than the CSRS employee, because they really can't take out their TSP yet unless they do a loan, as you said, or they can't really collect Social Security yet unless they're over their full retirement age. So I really think a FERS employee is going to really have to study this even more so than the remaining CSRS employees.
Okay, whether FERS or CSRS, purely a tax question. If they
You're
can,
asking me a no, tax
no, no,
question.
No, this is a tax question with with a technical answer, non-tax.
Okay.
You can front load the thrift. In other words, you can maximize the contributions to the thrift, even though you won't be there but half time. I'm guessing that they could still front load the thrift. Forget cash flow for just a second, even though they're half time.
Mm-hmm.
So that tax-wise, it would be attractive. Cash flow-wise, it would be unattractive unless they didn't need the money.
Yeah, they can still max out their thrift. They can still put the $17,500 and the $5,500 catch-up contributions, just as any other federal employee would be able to do. And I guess on another tax side of this, if the employee, let's say you have somebody doing this who's over 70 and a half, since they are still working, technically, they wouldn't be subject to the required minimum distributions, right?
On the thrift. But on the IRA, they would.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. So, but if they had their money pretty much wrapped up in the TSP, that would delay those distributions, if they wanted to delay them.
Okay, I'll amend my comment. The traditional IRA, the Roth IRA, there's no mandatory distribution. The Roth TSP, there is, but not until
you'd be exempt from it until you actually retire. Kind of interesting.
A lot of ends to be tied together, as they say. So your column was what, last week? This past Friday or the Friday before?
The Friday before, because last Friday I just wrote about the 80% retirement rule. So two weeks before that, I had one just introducing phased retirement and one getting into the weeds with it a little bit more. And of course, there will be more to follow once this actually comes about. You know, once the forms come out and people can do it, we will certainly probably dedicate at least another show or two to this topic, because I think it's going to be of great interest to some employees. Like I said, I think it's that niche of employees who are ready to retire financially, but just not quite there and aren't sure. They want to test the waters of having that extra time on their hands. And I think this will be a nice way to ease into it.
And for those of you maybe saying, what article? Tammy writes for GovExec every Friday, like you don't know, but just thought I'd mention that. And it was the Friday before last, which whatever date that was. And I liked your examples because you did one both for FERS as well as CSRS. You used a $100,000 example. I saw you got a little static from it, but I loved your response to it. It's easy to divide.
Yeah.
It's not to say everybody makes that. I like your responses to their
Yeah, sometimes I will go through the comments because there's some good questions that come in on the comments that you want to make sure that you can address where people might be confused. So I love when you write an article and you can comment afterwards.
Yeah, that's for those of you all, which I'm sure it's everyone, read her articles. I get a lot out of the article, but sometimes it takes you off the side, not totally into the weeds, but it goes one more. Well, what if? And your responses are always spot on. So.
It's the other thing, too, is I struggle with, it's kind of a blog, you know, as they say on the internet, it's a blog. It's not necessarily a fact-checked, you know, column, which is what the media is tending to get away from these days with the ability for anybody to write a column. So what I like about my column is that it is edited by the GovExec editor, so it actually is readable by the time it shows up, because what I send in is a lot of just how the way I talk. And then I think it's also fact-checked, because if I do write something wrong about Social Security, about federal retirement, I hear about it, and then we put the correction in. So I feel that I do as much fact-checking as I can, but it gets double fact-checked once it gets published.
All right, so. I get so wrapped around your words. There was the person that actually emailed this morning to you. Did you answer that question?
Yeah, pretty much so. Yeah, we got an email from Steve this morning, and hopefully he is listening to the show, because he was asking about electing survivor benefit options. And he said, would an applicant for phased retirement be required to elect a survivor option at the time of application for phased retirement? And I think I did say the answer is no, because you would make that election when you fully retired, which means if a phased annuitant who is still working were to die, the survivor benefit would be paid as a death in service. And if employees don't know what that means, if a civil service employee dies as an employee, it's almost as if you had retired the day you die. And if you're married, your surviving spouse would get 55% of your civil service retirement as a lifetime benefit. And kind of the nice thing, I was trying to look at the bright side, the nice thing about that, even though you're dead, is that the surviving spouse, you wouldn't have had to pay for that benefit as an annuitant. It would have been free.
All right. Thank you. All righty. We have a caller. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Good to have Tammy back after a long time.
Yes, I agree. Not that the other ones were bad.
I'm glad somebody missed me.
You are just as good in your area, but, you know, there are so many questions about the benefits part. In any case, Tammy, you know, this idea of the part-time retirement is good, but I suppose really when they pick up somebody, it's got to be these managers who do the picking.
Well, I guess it would be the employee, perhaps, who would make the request, and then the manager would have to say they go along with it or not. And I can see both a plus and a minus from a manager's point of view, because I think some managers might say, well, this is great because, you know, Sam was going to retire fully, and now we get to keep him a few more years, even if it is only 20 hours a week. Yeah. But then the other manager might say, oh, I was so glad to be getting rid of Sam, and now he's going to stay here for another 15 years. So I guess it depends on staffing levels and how much this is going to impact the budget of the agency. So, yeah, it can be a plus or minus.
It is not a secret that anybody who's retiring at this time, you know, others have to do the work that they leave behind.
That's right.
The government is not doing any hiring or anything like that. So this is a good program, but without a succession planning, which doesn't exist almost in any agency, this is This requires some enlightened managers.
All right. Well, you bring up another good point, because part of this requirement, when an employee is allowed to go into this, that one of the requirements of it is that they have to spend 20% of their time of the 20 hours a week. So I guess that's 4 hours a week that they would have to spend mentoring someone who is going to take their place. So in a way, I guess this is a way of maybe a little succession planning to allow that transfer of knowledge to go to the next employee who's going to take over.
Yeah, if it is actually done, and I think that certainly is very good. Now, I have a question for Bob.
Oh, good.
Bob, do the rules of, what you call beneficiaries remain like any other IRA for TSP, like the surviving spouse can regard that as her own?
Right. An account can be set up, and it's called a survivor's TSP account, and they would be treated much the same way prior to mandatory distribution. After,
oh, it has to be done before mandatory?
No. I'm saying before mandatory, it's same. Okay. Except they can't be adding anything. Once mandatory distribution hits, then the recipient, the spousal beneficiary, would then step in, but the spread would be over the survivor's lifetime.
Yes, that is the cool thing about it.
Yeah, it's
so
nice.
No difference whether you're in TSP or you have a self-directed IRA.
Okay, now I'm going to say, and this is very unfortunate, but this just recently happened, and I'm trying to find a back door to get into, and I'm finding it real hard to find a key. Individual is married. Individual, unfortunately, passes early in the year.
Yes.
Spouse is named as the survivor beneficiary. A survivor beneficiary account is set up. Unfortunately, the spouse dies 3 months later in the same calendar year. Beneficiaries are the children.
Okay.
The amount in the TSP is significant.
Yes.
The kids have to pay tax on it.
They can't set up a beneficiary.
They cannot pull it over to their own.
Nope.
Which can be done in a self-directed IRA.
Well, yeah, but remember, this is the TSP now. TSP,
I understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
So it makes no sense. But this, in some sense, it doesn't make any sense to keep the money after mandatory retirement. Might as well set up a self-directed IRA where you have much more control.
Or the surviving spouse puts it into an IRA. Yeah.
Okay.
That would have stopped it.
Well, yeah, because if the spouse inherited the T, or if let's say there was no spouse, let's say the guy died and there were three children, so his TSP could have been transferred to an inherited IRA. But since it went to the spouse first and stayed in the TSP as a spousal account, that's the key problem to this.
Yep.
So that would not be a problem if you take it out, send a self-directed IRA. Where your beneficiaries could be spouse, and then if spouse also dies, then your kid.
But it's kind of a message to those hopefully listening to say that if they were married, that the surviving spouse maybe should take that money and put it into an IRA and not leave it in the TSP. No disrespect to the TSP, disrespect to the tax law.
All right, sir. Thank you. You do a wonderful service to the federal community, both of you.
And we enjoy it.
Yeah, thank you for calling.
And Andrew. Andrew runs the show, of course.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Say hi to Andrew.
You'll be lost. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. I received an email and actually went to info at nitpinc.com. And it's a question I get in class. And the individual said, I have a retirement date of X. I'll be 57 and 9 months and 30 years of service. I will receive FERS and the supplement. I have figured the amount of annual income and not touch my TSP. I currently live in, I can say this, Maryland, and I plan to move to Delaware. How do I know how much taxes I will pay and how of X amount? And I had to write back, and I had to be frank, I don't know, and this is why I can't know. And I get this question an awful lot in class. The calculation of federal and state income taxes relative to retirement income can't be done without knowing the annual annuity, filing status? Is the person single? Are they head of household? Are they married? What other income do they have? Interest and dividends. Now, they were kind enough to say that there would be no thrift distribution. And then Social Security is probably a non-issue at that age. But then, what deductions do they have? Is there a mortgage? Are there charitable donations, et cetera?
Well, were they asking specifically about state income tax, since they mentioned moving from Maryland, where they tax
your
retirement
both.
To Delaware?
Well, yeah. The way I read it,
because federal would be
both.
The same no matter what state you live in.
Exactly. Yeah. But still, you'd have to do that. Now, here's where some people go, well, you know, that's why you came to class to answer these questions. But doing a tax return is not simple anymore. Because of the change in the tax law. So many people don't do it themselves. They use a computer-aided program themselves, or they have somebody do it. This is not a commercial. I don't know many people that do this manually anymore. It's just too hard. So what they could do is to take their prior year tax return, if they use their own software, and just save
the
return, and then just change the numbers to agree to what the numbers were going to be in retirement. You'll get your answer exactly what the taxes are going to be. It would also help with withholding. And then they can switch, if they lived, say, in Maryland, of course, they might have to buy the Delaware program. Mm-hmm. The Delaware isn't...
Is there a state income tax in Delaware?
Yeah, there's no sales tax.
Oh, no
but
sales
there is
tax.
No, but there is an income tax.
It's, do they exempt part of your retirement?
Yeah, it's almost as good as Maryland. Mm-hmm. Maryland has a really good exemption of close to $27,000 over and above the federal.
Do you have to be a certain age to get it?
You have to be 65.
No, that won't help the 55-year-olds.
No, it won't help the 55, and also it's reduced if they get Social Security income. But they don't tax Social Security income in either one of these two states, or in most cases,
yeah,
for that.
Most states.
You know, they don't tax it in D.C., Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and in most states. But the point is that your question is good, because there are a fair number of people that don't know that there's a tax exemption.
Well, I think the other thing that I think people get confused about is they think that income you get in your salary is somehow different than income you get in your retirement check. They think it's like capital gains or some weird tax thing. So I think some people are just looking for reassurance that income is income is income, whether it's coming from OPM as a retirement benefit or whether it's coming from your agency's payroll office. But I think the other thing they need to understand is that there is not a huge amount of it that's tax-free. Because you
very
know,
small at the federal level.
Yeah, and it represents what they paid into the retirement fund, which especially for a FERS employee, if you look at your paycheck, the smallest withholding is what you're paying into FERS.
Right, and spread out over a projected lifetime, that's
yeah.
rather optimistic.
Yeah. So I think I heard you say one time it's less than 5% tax-free and 95% taxable.
Yeah.
But it's taxed as ordinary income.
Right.
So that's the point.
Yeah.
Same with TSP withdrawals. If you're in a traditional thrift, some people think that is some weird tax thing. And that's, again, taxed as ordinary income.
IRS, I shouldn't say IRS. IRS, you know, unfortunately has to administer the laws passed by Congress. So Congress sees a dollar, they want to tax a dollar. Now, they might give favored treatment to some dollars, capital mm-hmm. gains, certain types of dividends and the like. But generally speaking, like you say, ordinary income would be from a salary, it would be from an annuity, it would be from an IRA distribution, not a Roth, but a traditional IRA.
So the only one of the three retirement benefits that really does get favorable tax treatment is Social Security. Because
yes.
even on the federal level, you're not going to pay 100% of it
at taxes. At the worst, it's 85%. And I would say for most of our listening audience, it is 85%
taxable.
But you
still get 15% tax-free.
That's what I tell them in class. It's tax-efficient. It's 15% mm-hmm. non-taxable, which is better than the annuity as far as the non-taxable portion. And
see, to me, that's also a reason why some people maybe should even delay it. Because if you get a bigger Social Security check in the end, like let's say when you're 70 or even 66, and you get 15% of that tax-free, then
and
you
no
don't
tax
have to
on
take
state.
As much out of your TSP. You can
right.
reduce your TSP withdrawals that are fully taxable, unless it's Roth.
Right.
Boy, I can see now why you talk a half a day on taxes and still don't answer all the questions.
Well, I try to keep it light, too.
Yeah.
If they take me to the weeds, I'll go there, but I try to stay out
keep
of
it,
them generally.
Keep it high level.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anyway, so I'm sorry to the person that emailed in, but I just couldn't give an accurate answer. Without knowing all that. But then again, if they use the program, they can do it themselves, mm-hmm. or if they use somebody to prepare it. I get calls all the time, what's my projected tax going to be next year? Because they want to know. They mm-hmm. they want to file estimated taxes or increase right. their withholding so they don't get a surprise, like maybe they got the prior year. or they're looking at taking money out of an IRA and they are retired, and that would kick up their Medicare premium on Social Security if they went into the next higher level.
Yeah, see, I think sometimes it's just the lingo, because I also hear, this is another tax thing I hear people say, oh, I don't want to take money out of my thrift because there's a penalty, there's a 20% penalty for taking the money out. Well, that's not a penalty. They're just helping you prepay your taxes, because that's money that you have to claim as income.
You're going to pay taxes, as Greg Long says, pay me now or pay me later.
That's right.
So they're going to withhold money, but they don't withhold state taxes.
No. So there you do have to be prepared for that shock in April.
Yeah. So, and then in the interim, when they first retire, there's no state withholding,
even if
you want it.
That's right.
Anyway, we're getting into taxes, and we have the brainchild of benefits here. And we said we'd talk about the Supreme Court ruling.
Yes.
Defense of marital.
No, defense. It's the overturning of the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Everybody just knows it as DOMA. But this is something, like, I've been getting questions for years about this from same-sex couples, and now we have more states than ever that are recognizing same-sex marriage. So if a couple gets legally married in their state, now we can provide benefits as in any other spousal arrangement. So OPM has been very much, I mean, I'm shocked at how quickly this information is coming out. So even Wednesday, when the date of the decision was made by the Supreme Court, OPM had issued a statement saying, we are on top of this, we're going to get this out as soon as we can. And the very next day, they had information out. So the acting director, Elaine Kaplan, I have to give her props for that. I was like, I never saw anything come out of OPM so quickly. So even on Friday, some information, if you go to opm.gov, you can read this yourself. It's I believe it's on the home page, a link to it. But there's a memo that came out from Acting Director Kaplan giving guidance on extension of benefits to married gay and lesbian federal employees, annuitants, and their families, which in essence allows you to switch from self-only to self and family health benefits, to provide family coverage under the life insurance program. We always could, at least in recent years, been able to do long-term care insurance for same-sex couples, but you now have a 60-day window to make that election if you weren't aware of it before. When you go into retirement, you can now elect a spousal survivor benefit rather than just an insurable interest. If you're already retired, you can go back and change the election from either insurable interest to spousal or from no survivor benefit to spousal benefits. Now, keep in mind, if you are retired and you're listening to this and you're saying, wow, this is great, I can do this. If you've been retired 10 years, you're going to have 2 years from the date of this decision, 2 years from last Wednesday, to make the election. But just as in any election like this made after retirement, you're going to have to pay for it back to the day you retired. So that's going to be almost 10% of your retirement, maybe for the last 10 years. And the way OPM has done this in the past, I'm assuming this is how it's going to work for this, is that you'll have an actuarially adjusted calculation. So instead of a 10% reduction for electing spousal survivor benefits, you might have a 14% reduction because you've been retired now for 10 years. So OPM will do those calculations for you when you make the request. So if you are interested in this, you can contact OPM as a retiree and make that election. I would probably say give them a few weeks to get their act together, because I'm sure they're going to get inundated with phone calls and emails about this change and wanting to do this right away. So if you are retired and you want to make a change for spousal survivor benefits, you do have 2 years from last Wednesday to make the change. If you're an employee and you want to change to family health benefits, you have 60 days to do it from last Wednesday. So they're giving you the same 60-day window as in any life event. So this is being treated apparently as a life-changing event, like anything else for changing your insurance benefits.
Okay.
So it's big news.
And to give the proper respect to our host here, Federal News Radio, there's a website, federalnewsradio, all one word, .com, and there's an article that was put out at 6:56 a.m. this morning. And Jack Moore, who's a writer with the station, and it's nice to get a couple links to it, so you'd want to read it online.
Yep. And it's a link to this memo as well, another way to find it.
Yeah. Anyway, the information is coming out. I'm not so sure every I is dotted and T crossed. But
yeah, there's still going to be questions that come up that haven't yet been answered. Because my question is this, maybe somebody who knows could call in. My question is, what if you live in a state where same-sex marriage is recognized, then you move to Virginia where it isn't yet. How would that affect those benefits that you had elected in the other state? I don't know, and I couldn't find the answer. So I will be researching that. But if anybody knows, please let me know.
Yeah. Then you know, I always look at it from the tax and the finance world. Two single people may, in fact, pay less in taxes if they have roughly the same income as a married joint. And there are some other tax issues with regards to it. But if you're married, you're married. And if you're married filing separately, you wish you never did because of taxes.
So there's basically the pre Supreme Court decision where you would have been filing as two single people, even though you were married in your state, right? Even though the state recognized it, it's still two single people. Now that you are legally married, or you might be getting legally married, now if you still want to file two single tax returns, there's a penalty. They can say
married filing separately is horrific.
Yeah, some people have called that the marriage penalty.
Yeah, it's pretty steep.
But you can file married filing jointly, but you'd be paying more tax than you were when you were single. Is that what
maybe
you were saying? Maybe not. It depends on the salary.
Two single people making roughly the same income will have less in taxes. Generally, not always, than these same two people did married filing joint.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a disparity, again, two single people, they're going to pay more in taxes. But if somebody's married, they have to file something called married filing separately. They can't do single. Married filing separately is just awful.
Yes. I heard that was because the IRS thinks you're hiding something if you're married filing separately.
Well, people... Years ago, I'm dating myself here, people could file married filing separately, and it was no big deal. Or somebody went down, flew down to, I won't say the country, there were a number of countries in this place called the Caribbean, and they could get married and divorced within 3 days. Of course, those 3 days might be December 30th and January 1st. So for tax purposes, they were not married.
So there was a loophole that they found.
Yeah, and so
they got a vacation out of it in the meantime.
Right, and it paid for it with the vacation. This was again a long time ago. So they did something called married filing separately and threw some other provision into the law,
so people couldn't put a penalty into it.
Yeah, and there were other reasons, but it's really a.
But the other thing you were saying in a couple, let's say. You have a married couple where one spouse is staying home raising the kids and the other spouse is working at a decent salary. Then marrying filing jointly is a benefit, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So if you have a disparity in the salary, one makes a high salary and one makes a very low salary or no salary,
that's great.
Then this is a real advantage. So talk to your accountant, right?
Right. And usually that comes up if a couple maybe isn't getting along and they want to file separately. And then you make the calculation and you go, it's a few thousand dollars more. What do you think? I think joint's just fine.
See, the other thing with this Supreme Court decision is beneficiary designations, you could have named whoever you wanted before. That doesn't change. But the federal order of precedence now changes. So that, prior to this overturning of the law, it was, your first beneficiary in line is your spouse. So if you didn't have a legal spouse, then it would have gone to your children, then parents, then, down the line. So now that you have a legal spouse recognized federally that your spouse is the automatic beneficiary, unless you've named somebody else.
Really?
Yeah. So that's something else. There's all kind of little nuances to this that I think are... Something that, if you weren't married before, recognized federally, you wouldn't have thought about. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions that come up about what do I do? How does this work? And how do you make the elections? What does it cost? What's the value? I can think of a whole list of questions about this.
I'm thinking maybe a show with you, me, and one of the attorneys. Mm-hmm. Generally, it's Mark Levine. But
I think,
He's coming on in a few weeks.
Maybe the listeners will let us know if this is something they'd like to hear more about and talk about from both a benefits point of view and a tax point of view and a financial planning point of view, because there's all kind of angles you can take on this.
Boy, these laws are a never-ending source of discussions for this show as well as the seminars, are they? And webinars, soon to be the webinars.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Last week I was at the Women in Federal Law Enforcement seminar or conference that was out in Palm Springs, which I'm glad not to be there now with the high temperatures. It was hot enough last week. But I was given a presentation there that I thought would be a perfect webinar, and they're like, yeah, it would. So I think webinars is becoming a more accepted type of training. So look for more of those, I think, in the coming days. And what's nice, I think, about doing a training period that you only have an hour or an hour and a half to do it, you can really laser focus on a topic and really detail it. And, you know, something like this overturning of DOMA would be a prime topic for a webinar, or the phased retirement would be another good topic to do a webinar on.
And for those listening that maybe never watched a webinar, it isn't really like watching the radio. There are PowerPoints up.
Yeah, and there's interaction because we do question and answer with the audience. And at the end of the webinar, I always open mine up to questions and try to answer as many as possible in the last 15 minutes. So I'm real excited about it. This is, I guess this is a commercial, but I do want to mention that that is something people should consider as a valid form of training, is this idea of webinars. Because the ones I've done, I've felt that it was almost a better interaction when I do a large group in some respects because of that laser focus on the topic.
How many emails? You told me the first one you did was a huge one.
Over 5,000 people had registered, which shocked
emails?
Me to death, because I've never had a seminar with more than 500, let alone 5,000. So I thought this is a great way to reach large audiences where maybe they otherwise wouldn't have the training.
Mm-hmm.
So
anyway, we're going to be doing
it. We're pursuing it. Yeah, we're trying to find the best way to do it.
Yep. All righty. So we got 7 minutes left, right, Andrew? If that much.
Did you give the phone number out today?
I did. Okay. 202-465-3080. Very slick, Tammy. 202-465-3080. So we're here to take calls on the two subjects that we did cover, or any other subject that you want to cover. I suppose maybe not legal, but we could take a stab at it. 202-465-3080. Now, in class, again, when I mentioned phased retirement, just last week, one, and it was a fairly heady group, and they go, what? And I said, well, read Tammy's article from the prior week at that time, and that'll get you going, but it works roughly like this, as best I could do. And they go, really?
I think there's some confusion a little bit, because this is such a new thing, and no one's doing it yet, that they're thinking I'm talking about, or maybe they think you're talking about, the other thing that people are also doing, kind of a novel idea, is that they're retiring from their agency, they're fully retiring, and then they're being hired back as an employee, as a reemployed annuitant. And in many agencies now, the employees are coming back as a reemployed annuitant, where they don't have to offset their salary, and they work full time in that condition, but it's a limited appointment. So this is different from that type of situation, a little bit different.
Okay, great. We have a caller. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Tammy, and hi, Bob.
Hi.
I wanted to ask a question about this part-time retirement. How does that affect your Social Security? Because I know there is a minimum amount that you can, a maximum amount you can earn before you get penalized on the Social Security end.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you're between the ages of 62 and your full Social Security age, which right now is 66, so in those 4 years, if you're earning above $15,120, that's it, $15,120 per year, for every $2 you earn above that, you lose a dollar of your Social Security. So if you're working in a phased retirement period where your income is still $50,000 a year or $40,000 a year, you know, you're well above that $15,000 limit. So my guess is most people, you know, most federal employees who go into this situation probably wouldn't be able to receive Social Security unless they were over their full Social Security age, where the earnings limit goes away.
Wow. Right.
But you would still be picking up Social Security credit, and those wages that you earn would still count towards the calculation of your Social Security. The only problem is your wages are cut in half.
Right.
So, you know, your income is going to go down. It's not going to go down to zero, but it's going to go down to half of what it was. So it's not going to have the same impact on your future Social Security as if you were working full time.
Okay, that's great. I do have a comment on the retirement seminar you were talking about, mm-hmm. where possibility of doing like webinars.
Right.
I think that would be a good idea. I'm not really quite sure how it would work. Mm-hmm. I know at my agency we are actually the first time we're actually briefed on any sort of retirement issues is 5 years before we actually can qualify to retire.
That's almost too late, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
If you made mistakes, you can't go back 25 years and fix them.
Right.
That's why I think this is good, because these could be offered to employees of any age. And like I was saying, and like you mentioned, we could, you know, kind of super laser focus on topics that might be of interest to a mid-career employee or a newer employee. And it's not going to take, you know, a full day of their time.
Right. Okay. Well, thanks a lot for the show. I really do enjoy it.
Well, thank you so Great. Much for calling.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye. All righty. We're in the two-minute countdown.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to mention before we do run out of time is, and I don't know all the answers to this, but if you are divorced and you have a former spouse who has a divorce, if you have a divorce decree awarding part of your retirement to your former spouse or survivor benefits, then you want to wait until these full regulations come out for phased retirement, because there are some things in there that are being addressed. You know, how do we work that? Does the former spouse get half of their award and things like that? You may have to end up going back to court to clarify.
Yeah, is that what you were alluding to? This could require, it could, and we're not saying it is,
yeah,
but it could require a court order, which means back to court.
Yeah. This is the part that I need to read 3 and 4 times over before I understand it. Maybe have to talk to an attorney.
Okay. And or the OPM. Yeah. Anyway, we're about at the finish line. Tammy, great to see you again.
Glad to be here.
All right. And thank you all for listening. Spread the word, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.